Vegan Market, Bucky's birthday party?
Freaking miracle. There you go.
Welcome to the Abracadam Podcast, and I'm your host, stand-up comedy magician Danny Whitson. Like always, Abracadamans, I hope you're getting stuff done, son. Meeting them goals. Yes. It has been a crazy week here at the Whitson Castle. Plumbing problems. Yeah, been dealing with plumbing issues, and God, that sucks. Yeah, because I absolutely have no plumbing skills at all. None. I mean, if something goes wrong in my house, if I can't tell it a joke or show a card trick, I'm screwed. So, but yeah, luckily, have a very skillful person over here working on it. So, dealing with the pipes. So, I apologize. I said I would be getting these episodes back on Fridays. Well, we're back on Saturday. Hopefully, next week, we get back on track on our regularly scheduled Fridays. Other than that, I want to get things rolling here with this episode. So let's get moving and give a big shout out for the local sponsor for today's episode. Okay. Well, today's episode is brought to you by Rosie Tattoos. Custom tattoos designed to suit your style in a friendly and clean environment. I've been getting my tattoos done by Rosie for a while now, and I couldn't recommend anyone else because she does excellent work. As a matter of fact, I got an appointment to see Rosie here in just a few weeks, and I cannot wait to get my ink therapy done, baby. Rosie gets free consultations by Facebook Messenger, Instagram, or by email. Shoot her an email at rosietattoos@yahoo.com. Give Rosie a call today at 865-281-3451. Or go see Rosie at 5710 Kingston Pike, Knoxville, Tennessee. Get your ink therapy done. You know you want a tattoo. Go see Rosie Tattoos. All right, Abracadamans. Now, today's guest is a super cool dude. He does everything. He is a variety act rolled into one person. He does magic, sideshow, comedy, juggling, everything, you name it. He's literally been everywhere. You may have seen him on Howard Stern show. You may have seen him on the Jay Leno show. He performs 5 days a week at Zach Bagan's Haunted Museum in Las Vegas, and also performing on a show called Late Night Magic in Las Vegas as well. But anyways, if you will, Abracadamans, sit back and relax and enjoy my fun conversation with, I'm going to say, entertainer, John Shaw. All right, I'm excited. We got entertainer John Shaw on the Abracadam podcast today. How you doing, John?
I'm great. How you doing, man?
Doing good. I tell you what, now, if you don't mind, do you go ahead and introduce yourself to the Abracadam listeners?
My name is John Shaw. I am originally from New York, but I've been living in Las Vegas since 1995, and I'm a professional entertainer of sorts. I specialize in everything from magic and illusions to circus sideshow stunts, comedy, a little bit of juggling, and all that kind of, and everything in between, pretty much.
Well, what's awesome about you, John, is like you are a walking variety show. I mean, literally, you can go on YouTube and see your clips of everything that you do. And it's super cool. Magic, comedy, sideshow stuff, so it's super cool. So many places we can go with you from the start, but what happened first? Where did you go?
So the very first thing I got into was magic. That was my first love. And that started probably when I was around first grade. I saw a magician. So this guy was really smart. We had the class assemblies and stuff that they would do. You know, they'd have somebody come in and talk about something or teach you something. So there was a guy who was really a genius when you think about it. He was a science guy, but he used magic as a way to explain science. So it made it entertaining. And anytime you can entertain children and teach them at the same time, they're going to absorb that information 10 times better, right? So, of course, I don't remember much about the science, but I do remember the magic tricks that he did. And one of the big ones he did was he poured, water into a big bucket, and then he threw it, and it was like confetti. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. You know, and he did like a dove pan, and he had like a couple other props, stuff like that. And it was just neat. It was super cool. And I was like blown away, and I went home, and I was like, Mom, I want to do magic. And she's like, well, that's nice, son. And, you know, and my dad had these two magic tricks, Marshall Brodeen stuff. He had a Svengali deck, which is for those of you guys who might not know, you can buy it at a local magic shop. It's a magic deck of cards, and it does all kinds of stuff. And he had a penetrating picture frame. So the one where you put the two playing cards and then you push the pencil through the frame. And when I was a little kid, that was the most amazing thing. So when my parents weren't home, I would sneak into my parents' room, and he had those two tricks in his dresser drawer, and I would steal them out of his dresser drawer and go in my bedroom and play with the magic tricks and try to figure out how to do stuff. So, for the longest time, I couldn't figure out how the picture frame thing worked. And then one day I finally figured it out, and I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. You know, and, I went and took a deck of cards that my parents had that they used for like, you know, just playing cards at home. And I ruined every card because of course I'm like stabbing all the cards. But, I got my first magic kit probably, maybe about 9 or 10 years old, between 8 and 10, somewhere in that range. And it was a Blackstone magic kit. And I got it from a toy place called KB Toys, which was a popular toy place in New York. And I had the beginner set, and I went home and I just played with that thing. I went in my room, locked myself in there, and for hours and hours and hours, I just played with magic tricks. And the first one I remember doing was the bottle. It's a bottle with the pincher. It has a little rubber band. You know, the one that has a rubber band. You're supposed to link it on and stuff. So that was the first one that I tried, and I'm reading the instructions, and it says you hook the rubber band onto the end of this thing, and I couldn't get it to work, and I was so frustrated. And then I was messing with it, and I messed it up, and it went bink, and it worked. And I'm like, oh. So I didn't understand the instructions. The instructions were terrible. But then I figured out. So then I started doing it, and then I was doing like cups and balls and like all kinds of different things. And then I bought the medium level set, and eventually the advanced set. And then I put on magic shows for anybody who would watch, mostly my mom and my grandmother. I would torture them with watching my really crappy magic shows. And they were very, you know, enthusiastic and supportive. And they're like, well, you know, we could see this or we could see that. You should try that differently. And they were good though, but it was constructive criticism. And it taught me, and it hurt my feelings, but at the same time, I was like, oh, I got to get better. So then I went and practiced more and more and more and more. Then when I was a little bit older, I was in Cub Scouts and Weeblos and Boy Scouts. I did all the scouting program stuff. And we had blue and gold dinners. For those of you guys who might not be familiar with scouting, at the end of the year, there's a big blue and gold dinner, and they give out awards and then all kinds of fun stuff. Well, they had a magician there, and he was catching the doves in midair and then putting them in the cage. And he had like rainbow ropes and, you know, and he did all the different magic tricks and stuff. And I went up to him afterwards. I'm like, hey, I do magic too. And he's like, oh, really? I'm like, yeah, I got the Blackstone magic kits. I was all excited to tell him. And he was like, oh, well, that's nice. Meanwhile, it's like now that I look back at him, like he's looking to me like, whatever, kid. But he played along. And I was like, listen, I really want to buy professional magic, but I don't know where to go. And he's like, oh, he's like, okay. Well, and he gave me the phone number to a guy. His name was Stan Winston. Stan Williams. I remember the guy to this day. He was the first professional magician that ever helped me. And he's like, this guy sells magic out of his house. I was like, ooh, that's fun. So I got the guy's phone number. I called him up and made an appointment to go over to his house. I told him I'm you know, very beginner, don't know anything. I have plastic magic tricks basically. And he's like, okay, we'll come over and we'll see what you can do. And then we'll go from there. I'm like, okay. So I went there. I remember going down into his house and going down the basement, and you could smell the mothballs and you know, all that kind of stuff. And then he flicked on the lights and the lights came on in the room, and there was floor to ceiling magic books, magic tricks, Mac magic. So it was like stuff with Chinese writing on it and sparkly tape and prism tape and all this. There was swords and there was all kinds of stuff. And I was like, oh, it was like Mecca to me as a little kid. I was like, this is amazing. This is the greatest place I've ever been. And he was the greatest thing about what he did for me was tell me to not buy stuff out of my skill range. He's like, I won't sell you something you can't do. And I was like, but I want to do everything. And he's like, yes, but no. And he was the first guy that actually really mentored me. And I remember what I bought. I bought Ickle Pickle Nickel. I don't know if you remember
yes,
that.
Yes, baby.
Right? I had Ickle Pickle Nickel. I had a mini Stratosphere and sponge balls. This the set of the Goshman inch and a half sponge balls and a thumb tip. And I got scotch and soda.
Nice.
And that was the first things he laid. He's like, here, you got this. He's like, this is a nice variety of stuff. He's like, now you go home and you practice all this stuff and you come back in like a month and you show me what you can do. And then I'll sell you, see if you can buy stuff from there. And he told me, this is what's going to happen in your magic career. You're going to buy a bunch of stuff. And then you're going to realize you don't like a lot of that stuff and you're going to get rid of it or sell or just stop using it. He's like, you got to find what it is that you want to do. He's like, and until you find who you are as a magician, you're going to buy a bunch of stuff. And I was like, and he told me, he's like, the best things you can buy are books. He's like, you can buy all the props and tricks and stuff in the world, but books have tons and tons of tricks in there that you can learn and become really good at with just random, regular, everyday objects. And I was like, well, I don't want a book. I want a cool thing with prism tape on it that looks like it's from, you know, China. I was like, so I can be magical, a wizard and stuff. And, but he was really good. I had the Bobo's, coin book and, you know, he gave me a hot rod. I got a hot rod and I had the book with the, 101 different hot rod tricks and all that stuff. And I just practiced. I mean, I brought it to school. I did all day long. That's all we do is do magic tricks for people.
You know what?
And that's really how it started.
What's interesting is, you know, it was similar like that for me too, except I think I was a little bit older. I was kind of a late bloomer. I was like 18. But it's interesting how, like, in the beginning, how you buy those toys, because at the time that's what it feels like, it's toys. But then later on, you realize some of those items are tools.
Yeah.
You know, after you do, learn in books and you learn these things and you can go back. And so I think the process, the way that happens is, you know, the process is there for a reason. And it's awesome. It's one of the funnest things in magic is the process.
It's a journey. You go on this journey and you're going to figure out the genre of magic that you want to do. And you're going to buy and sell a ton of stuff before you get to that where you're going to, all of a sudden you're going to find your niche and you're going to be like, okay, this is my path and this is where I'm going.
Well, what's, interesting with you, you started out with magic. So where did the sideshow come?
Sideshow stuff?
Yeah.
So the sideshow stuff, I first got introduced when I was 10 years old. I went to a sideshow and there was a circus called the Clyde Beatty Cole Brothers Circus. And which is an East Coast circus, and there was a sideshow there. My dad was a cop, so they had hired the police department. He was a deputy sheriff. They hired the deputy sheriffs to be security for this circus. So on the one night, the one afternoon, morning, whatever that he had, he wasn't doing it. He brought the family, all of us, to the circus. And of course, I'm a little kid who doesn't love a circus. But there was a sideshow there. I don't remember any of these people's names. And I wish I did because I just I was too young to really kind of really commit anything to memory, but I remember the different acts and, there was a sword swallower there. And I remember because the sword swallower knew who my father was. So he picked me out of the crowd to go up on stage and it was like this little platform box and they were all the different performers were on these boxes in a circle. And, you'd walk from box to box to box and they all did their little shtick. Right. So he called me up from the crowd and he got down on his knees and he's like, I'm going to swallow the sword. When I wink at you, grab the handle and just pull it straight up in the air. And I was like, okay. So he got on his knees and he swallows the sword. He winks at me. I pull the sword up. And I remember to this day, clear as day, I remember seeing, feeling and hearing the sword scraping against his teeth as it came out and the little gasp of air that escaped. Right as the sword came out of the esophagus, and it was like, And he was like, now hold it up in the air. And I held it up in the air and the people went crazy. And of course, as a 10-year-old kid, I thought I did something amazing, which I didn't. But in my little kid brain, I was amazing. And the place went crazy. And that just blew my mind. And then there was a fire eater there. And there was a snake charming girl. And they had a blade box. And I remember the blade box because there was a really pretty girl. And she went up there and it looked like they, you know, they do the costume bit where they looks like they pull her costume off. And I was like, well, I want to go see that. And so my mom was like, come on. And we gave him $1 and we went up there and she was all snaked around the blades and stuff. And I was like, ooh, this is great. I was like, I don't know what this is, but I like whatever this is. I was like, I wanted that. I didn't know what it was, but I knew I wanted it. And when I was like 11, 12 years old, I started experimenting with fire eating. And
now here, yeah. Hold on real quick. Okay. Now as a kid, if you want to get into magic, there's, you know, you get a kit and stuff like that, but now wait a minute.
Yeah.
As a fire eater though, I mean, yeah. Is there any, there's not like a yeah. kit, you know, right?
No, no. And there was no internet. You gotta, you know, there's no internet. This is like early 80s, no internet. And so I, of course I didn't know how to make fire eating torches. The only thing I had at the house were my mom's cotton swabs and oh my god, what's this? the things you put in your ear. I can't remember the name of it.
Q-tips.
So I took the cotton swab and I wrapped it around the Q-tip and I took some lighter fluid and sprayed it on there. And that was my first fire eating torch, was this little thing. And I was like, I put my head back and I'm like, you know, and I just extinguished it in my mouth. And I was like, ooh, that's neat. And then a while later, so that was my first like try at it. And of course I didn't show my mom or dad anything. You know, I was doing it. I knew that they would yell at me if they knew I was playing with all this dumb stuff. And, so as I got a little bit older, right around like 13, I met a fire eater at a magic show and I was like, I want to learn how to eat fire. He's like, ah, you're probably too young for that. And I was like, well, I'm already doing this. And he's like, oh, and he's like, well, I'm not going to tell you how to do it, but you should go ask, you know, this other guy. And I was like, okay. So then I went back to that guy, Stan Williams, and I was like, I want to eat fire. And he's like, I don't know. And I told him what I was doing. He was like, all right, well, he's like, get some cotton swab, big cotton balls, 100% pure cotton. He's like, and you tie them onto a coat hanger, and you put the lighter fluid on, and you put it in your mouth. He's like, you just breathe out. Just remember, never breathe in, always breathe out. I'm like, okay. So that's how I started doing it. And it was a terrible, terrible routine, of course, because the torches were tiny. The things I use now are huge and produce like a, you know, 2.5-3 foot flame. But
you were the only kid in the neighborhood, though, who were doing
it. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was the only kid eating fire. And I started doing birthday parties by that point, too. So I had amassed enough tricks that I was doing them for free. I had amassed enough tricks, and the most expensive trick I owned was a chalet, balloon to dove tray.
Cool.
And
nice.
Yeah. And that was, I remember it was $75 and my mom and dad bought it for me for Christmas. And I was just like, this is the most amazing thing in the world. And I'm like, at my best friend's younger sister had a birthday. And they hired me for free, of course. But I didn't care. I just wanted to do magic. And I went there and I did the magic thing. My dad built me like a magic table and stuff. And so I had shelves and I could put my little tricks on it and stuff. And I went there and I did all the things. And I did like, I'm probably 20 or 30 minutes, something like that. And I just thought I was the king shit. You know what I'm saying?
Dude, that's awesome because, I mean, first of all, man, stress the importance of, you know, having parents that support what you're into and yeah. what you're doing. And then also, yeah, I mean, it was pretty awesome. You had your own little magical Mr. Miyagi too. You could go to him and he, all right.
Yeah. You know, it was very helpful because he got me into the SAM club, the local SAM club in New York, actually in Poughkeepsie, New York, was SAM number 35, club. And that was the Al Baker Assembly. And that was the one that I belonged to. And there was a bunch of magicians there. And of course, you know, I'm like this, you know, little teenage, you know, I'm like 12, 13 years old And, you know, my mom had to drive me to the thing. The meeting, my mom, you know, would sit in the back of the room and, you know, what, wait for me to do this meeting and stuff. And they would like teach tricks and they had lectures and stuff. And I was just enamored by all of it, of course. And, but that he really helped me and steered me in the right direction so that I would learn what I wanted to do and stuff rather than just selling me a bunch of crap just to make money. And that was the great thing about him. And my parents, of course, being very supportive, my grandparents and stuff, by just watching me over and over and over again do all these magic stuff. And every time I got something new, you know, they're like, go practice it a bunch before you show it to us so you get good at it. And then you show it to us and then we'll tell you what we see and what's good and what's bad. So, you know, that it really helped me learn so much faster and also learn about constructive criticism and learn how to take criticism rather than, you know, get mad at it, because a lot of magicians don't take criticism very well. And I mean, I've been hired to come in and help people tweak their shows, and then literally they'll pay me money to do it. And then I tell them what I see is wrong. And then they're like, no, I don't think that's right. I'm like, okay, then why am I here? Like, I mean, you're paying me money to be here. Why am I here if you don't want to listen to what I have to say? So, it's just, you know, I always tell people, I mean, I don't give advice unless it's really wanted or you're paying me. One thing I learned, there's a magician named Joaquin Ayala, who's a very good friend of mine. And he even said, he's like, I very rarely will give advice to anybody, even friends, unless they're paying me. He's like, because nobody listens closer than when you're paying for something.
That's true.
And I was like, he was like, because you just throw out, maybe you should try it like this. They're like, oh yeah, whatever. You know, you don't pay much attention, but if you're paying somebody a couple hundred bucks an hour, you're going to listen to what they have to say.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's also important as a performer to get another set of eyes to look at your act.
Oh, absolutely. You know? When I met Jeff McBride around probably 86, 87. And I was completely, I had started doing magic with masks and stuff. I had no idea who Jeff was, but I started like exploring and expanding like the kind of magic that I wanted. Cause I was like, I was more of a rock and roll kid. Like I was a heavy metal guy, like Twisted Sister and Kiss and Alice Cooper. And I was like, fuck, I want to do magic like that. Like I want rock star magic. So I started experimenting with different weird like costumes and trying to take on like spooky guy look and all that kind of jazz, which eventually obviously has become my entire image. But I started doing that like when I was like 15, 16 years old. And I was like, man, I want to really explore like darker and creepier stuff. And, I met a guy at the SAM club who did bizarre magic, and I didn't know what that was. Oh. And it was all the storytelling. He got up there and he had all these really cool props and stuff from Egypt and scrolls and voodoo dolls. And I'm like, what the hell is that? I'm like, this is amazing. And he, you know, opened my mind and my brain to all kinds of other stuff. And I'm like, this is all these other things are possible. And I got really into bizarre magic. And that's kind of when Jeff McBride and I connected. Somebody was like, hey, you're doing stuff with masks. You got to see this guy. And they gave me a VHS tape of some of his show. And I was like, oh, my God, this guy's amazing. Well, I finally reached out to him and met him and stuff. And I was like, I'm doing stuff with masks, too. I thought I was being all cool. And he was not very happy about that. Because he was like, well, this is really my thing. And I'm like, yeah, no, I want to do like you're doing. He's like, no, you have to do your own thing. And Jeff was really good like that, because he was another guy, like, I mean, because I started copying him, like, verbatim. Like, I was doing all the stupid mask tricks after I saw it, and I thought it was really cool, and I showed him, and he's like, why are you doing my act? And I'm like, but because it's cool. He's like, no, that's not what you do. And this is before the very first Mystery School ever existed. And then he said, I'm putting together this thing called Mystery School with a guy named Eugene Berger and Bob Neal and all these people. And I'm like, what's that? And he's like, well, it's this whole thing with like, you know, exploring the history of magic and the mystical side of magic. I'm like, ooh, that sounds fun. You know, and so I was part of the original Mystery Schools that took place in upstate New York. I'm trying to remember the name of the town. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but I remember the name of the place. It was called the Nanda Ashram. was where it was first held. Super cool. And I was the very first, because I was, you know, broke kid. I didn't have any money. And I was the very first person to ever get a mystery school scholarship for mystery school. And I had to work the entire thing and then do the classes. So, you know, I was running around, you know, being the gopher for him and everybody else that needed anything. And you know, set up the magic room and set up this and set up that. But I just didn't care. I just wanted to do it and I wanted to learn. And I didn't care what I had to do to get to that. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, they don't understand. You got to put in, a lot of people want to be YouTube stars, and that's great. You could be Facebook stars. You could be YouTube stars, you know, Instagram stars. There's all different kinds of magic now. Some of my closest friends, like Rick Lax and all those guys, are killing it online, making a boatload of money. And all these people that sit there and go online and hate them, and like every time you comment how much you hate them, you're literally making them more money. By the way, that's how it works. It's yeah. The interaction. It doesn't matter what it says. But it's there's, you know, but you got to be willing to do whatever it is. If you want something bad enough, you got to be willing to do it for free and just do it and do it and get out there and just do as many shows as you can. And that's the only way you're going to get better. You're never going to get better just sitting in your room. You that's have true. To do it for people. You that's have true. To perform for people.
Well, let's, this is something I want to, because first of all, it kind of, I guess in some ways, you just met Jeff McBride by chance, correct? I mean, it was.
Well, he, he was friends. One of my friends went to Tanned's Magic Camp and Jeff was there.
Okay.
And then he came up to our SAM club and then that's how I met him. And then he gave me his phone number and he's like, why don't you come over to my apartment, my house in Goshen, New York, and hang out and we'll talk about magic. And that really opened up the whole world.
Well, the cool thing, when I look back, okay, I look back at my early days when I was first learning magic and I stumbled across Eugene and Jeff McBride stuff. And yeah, I was still in the trick chasing mode. So it was tricks. And whenever Jeff and Eugene would talk about, you know, putting yourself into your magic and presenting it in your way, you know, I was kind of like, I just want tricks, you know.
Yeah.
But now I go back. And I look at what they were teaching and I'm thinking, man, that was brilliant. That was so valuable information right there. And there's a lot of guys and girls out there in magic who unfortunately, some of them never find that gold information, that they become a clone of their favorite person. And that's all they, you know, with you, John, now it's clearly that you have your own identity. You are a very unique performer. No one, you know, I mean, it's you. Do you credit that to Jeff's mystery school kind of helping you?
I credit it to, I've been super fortunate. Because of Jeff, I've had great people in my life that helped mold me into what I've become now. And it took a while. It didn't happen overnight. It took years. But he introduced me to Eugene. And then Eugene introduced me to Max Maven. And, you know, I got to meet Bob Neal and spend many, many hours and lots of days and nights hanging out at diners with all these guys. And they were brutal. I mean, Eugene, Max there is no punches pulled. If you wanted to be better, they would help you. But you were going to get beaten up, man. If it was not good, they were not going to be nice about it. Dude, you know, Eugene awesome. Was much nicer. I would say Eugene is a little bit softer than Max's critiques. But, you know, Max's critiques were fantastic. And they really helped me develop the character that would eventually become who I am now. But it took a long time. Like, I was a McBride clone for a number of years, man. It took me a while to walk away from that and just decide to be me. You know, because I had stupid stage names, too. Like, I was Jakar and I was Scorpio and all these stupid ass names. And, you know, and seriously. And I remember my first magic like shirt that I had made. It was like the magic of Scorpio. And I gave it to Eugene. I remember sitting in the front, he's in the front seat of my car. We were on the way to go get food at a diner. And I'm like, hey, I got this shirt. I want you to have it. And he looks at it. He's like, and it was like a genie lamp with smoke coming out, and it spelled the magic of Scorpio, and magic was MAGICK, because I was trying to be different.
Yeah.
And he was like, John, it's a very nice shirt, but why are you using this name? He's like, why don't you just use your name? And I'm like, well, because it's not like magical and cool. He's like, no. He's like, you have a great name. He's like, it's a good name. It's easy to say. It's easy to remember. It's four letters for the first and last name. He's like, it's a great name. Why don't you use it? And I'm like, well, cause I don't, and he's like, cause you, and he's, and that, that's when I just, that moment I started, I didn't really realize it, but it took a while that he was telling me, I haven't found me yet. I'm still pretending to be these other people. And the very first TV show that I ever did was called The Jenny Jones Show in Chicago. And I remember that was the very first professional TV show I ever did. And I went to Eugene's apartment the night before and we had pizza and we sat in his apartment talking for hours about magic and, you know, what I was, and he was like, you know, well, for this show, how are they introducing you? Are you going to be Scorpio or are you going to be John Shaw? I was like, well, I'm going to be John Shaw. And he's like, yes, be who you are. He's like, stop trying to be who you think you should be. And I'm like, and it didn't resonate to me for a little while. It took a bit of time. And then eventually I was like, I realized like my sense of humor was coming through little by little by little. And that was all due to another, two big inspirations to me, which was The Amazing Jonathan and Kozak. And, you know, we just had the memorial for Jonathan here, like a week or so ago. And I was, you know, honored when they asked me, I got to perform his, knife through arm routine. So, and it was, yeah, it was like, and I bought that knife from through arm from him and I had never used it. I just kept it in a box and I was like, oh, it's just cool. I just keep it. And then when, Anastasia, when his wife asked me to do it, she's like, this is the trick you need to do for him. And I was like, okay. You know, and it was so cool. But Jonathan and Kozak were the guys that were my comedy magic inspirations. And they taught me that you could be wild over the top, which is really my deep down personality, even though I was trying to be mystical and magical and all that stupid crap. And it wasn't really me. I wanted to be funny. That's what I loved to be. I loved being the Klaus clown and telling dirty jokes and being wild. And those guys were, I used to stay up late and watch those TV shows. And I was like, man, these guys are amazing. And then years later, I become friends with them and they became mentors to me. And so, like I said, when I tell people, like, I'm so fortunate to have these people in my life and, you know, Kozak, I still is in my life and he's still a good friend, you know, you know, it's just like unbelievable. I sit back and I look at how fortunate I am to have these great people in my life that helped me be me. And it took a while.
Now, where you can, because I mean, you are absolutely an entertainer, and you said you were putting on shows as a child, doing these things, doing the free shows and stuff. But when did you? What age was it that you stepped out and you were like, okay, I really enjoy standing in front of audiences and performing and entertaining? Like how you mentioned, you do have to get out of your bedroom. You know what I mean? If you want to do this.
You can't just do stuff in, you just can't do magic forever. I mean, if you're going to be an internet magician, that's great. Then you can stay in your room and just do internet magic. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's an entire group of people that are your audience for that. And that is a real gig and that's great. It's not my thing. But I don't knock people for doing it either, because there's a lot of great guys out there who are killing it, and especially during the pandemic, where else were you going to do magic, right? So, you know, there's nothing wrong with that kind of stuff. And a lot of magicians are pushing back against these guys. And I'm like, it's just different. We're old and we just don't like it because we don't understand it. But we, you know, that's really what it is. You know, we don't understand. Like it's not my thing, but I get it. Like, yeah. I'm like, no, I wish I could do that. I tried it. I'm just not good at it. I like doing stuff on a stage with lights and,
well,
you know, pretty girls.
I'm addicted to that audience, you know.
That
energy in a room full of human beings, can't beat that. You know, that's just,
I was 15 when I got my very first paid professional show. I made $25. I remember it to this day. And it was my friend's dad, my father's friend, I'm sorry. my father's friend who worked on the police department, and they were having a birthday party for this kid, and they were like, hey, would you come and do the thing? We'll give you $25. Like, yeah, great, no problem. I came there and I did. I mean, I did like 45 minutes worth of stuff. I was like going crazy, but I didn't care. But the guy, as a gift, the guy bought me my very first lavalier mic, which was a Radio Shack crappy microphone. But to me, hey, it was amazing. You know, I had a wireless microphone that I could clip to my, you know, my lapel or whatever. Yeah. And I was like, I'm becoming professional. And then I started taking money and that I was doing when I was working and investing it into the show. And I bought a little crappy sound system. Realistic. Do you remember the Realistic systems?
Oh yeah.
Radio
yeah.
Shack. So yeah. All my stuff was Realistic. It was terrible. But you know, I mean, I was 15, 16 years old. I was like killing it. And I remember the first time that I discovered being an a-hole to people was funny. And I was like 15, maybe 16. And I got hired at a haunted house to do entertainment on the stage while the people were waiting in line. And I'm like, I'm out there and I'm doing my thing. And I got like Crystal Silk Cylinder and Jumbo Stratosphere. And I got a straight jacket and I'm doing all this kind of escapes and all kinds of crazy stuff. And I had the lavalier mic on and it was the first show I ever did with it. And I'm up there and I'm not very good, clearly. And, but I thought I was killing it. And I did this trick and some guy yells something out and was heckling me. And I was so green, I didn't know what to say. I'm like 15, I don't know. Like, I didn't know. So, but I was getting really frustrated because he just kept pounding me for like a big portion of the show. So I went to go put the Crystal Silk Cylinder down underneath my little table. And I leaned over and I was like, you're an asshole. And I yelled it into the microphone and it went out over the speakers. And I came up and I had this big look like, oh shit. And the crowd started roaring. And I was like, bing. And this little light bulb flipped onto my head and I'm like, so when people are mean to you and you say things back, that's funny. Ah. And so then I started really looking into like stand-up comedians. My mom had a Phyllis Diller album.
Nice.
And I listened to that over and over again. And one of my friend's fathers had a Red Fox album. And that's where I learned a whole lot of things.
yes.
I learned a whole lot of stuff on that album. I didn't know what he was talking about, but people were laughing. So I was like, I just started mimicking what he did. And I was like, well, if I say this, and I started saying stuff like that around adults, and they would laugh. I'm like, oh, this is something. I don't know what it is, but it's something. And that, you know, fueled my passion. Then I discovered Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy and, you know, all these other guys. And I discovered Mel Brooks and the History of the World Part One. And, you know, I started like Porky's and all this stuff. And I was like, I started absorbing all this dirty comedy. And I was like, I don't know. I wasn't really 100% sure what it was I was talking about, but I knew people laughed when I talked about it. So that was my start.
One thing I got to bring up, because this is something that this took me a few years to figure it out with my act, is combining stand up with magic, you know, to where you're not, you know, sometimes you've heard the old saying, oh, well, if the comedy's good, the magic usually sucks, and the magic's good, the comedy's, you know, vice versa. And well, combining the two to make them both work took me a few years to figure it out. I finally figured it out. But with you, you've got multiple things, not just, you know, I had two things. You've got several things. How long did it take you to figure this formula out to make all these things work in your act?
I perform 5 days a week at the Zach Bagans Haunted Museum downtown in Las Vegas, right? So I also work with the Ghost Adventures TV show, doing paranormal stuff with them, because that's also another hobby passion of mine. And so I'm part of the tour. So the tour is like 2 hours and I'm in the circus sideshow section. He's got all this great, like P.T. Barnum stuff and antique, circus stuff. And there's a whole section where he has like freak show stuff. And so that's where I am. And I mean, I'm doing, you know, up to 30, 40 shows a day in this place.
Wow, 30 to 40 a day.
So the shows are only 10 minutes long,
okay,
but I'm doing
okay.
30 to 40 a day.
Well, still,
and I am pounding away at working. Like every time a group comes in, I change stuff a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here. You know, just inflections, adding like a weird hand or a weird face, tilting my head back, forward, left, right, trying to figure out what works best. And I do this every day. I have 5 days a week. I experiment every single show, every single day. I never stop trying to find the way. Now, some things I've nailed down and I'm like, okay, bam, these are winners every time. Bum, 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 bum. And then there's some things where I'm like, I try new stuff. And sometimes it's just like, you know, just a weird expression or changing the pitch of my voice.
Absolutely.
You know, when I say, or, you know, all these little things. And it's comedy for something that's supposed to be so funny. It's so serious because you really have to figure out what makes the majority of people laugh. You're not going to make everybody laugh, but the majority of people laugh. And so that formula is hard.
Yeah. It's amazing just by sometimes when, you know, by raising your voice sometimes a little more or lowering the changes. It's definitely not a masterpiece. It's something that's evolving. Now, let me do this because I do got to bring this up. First of all, my wife would kill me if I didn't bring this up, John. She is a diehard paranormal person. She loves all the shows. We go on ghost investigations and stuff together and stuff, so she loves that. Let's hear about this, man. Let's hear about your paranormal side.
I've for probably, I don't know, like mid-2000s, I've always had a fascination with like spooky stuff and haunted houses, but mostly theatrical haunts. That was always my thing. But I loved horror movies and I loved ghost stories and I loved all those things. And when I discovered that ghost hunting was an actual thing, which I didn't know, I was like, whoa, this is neat. But of course I didn't know how to go about it. But I loved going to places that were supposedly haunted. So I would go in like, you know, my mom also loved that stuff. So that was super helpful. And she would drag me. She's like, oh, let's go to this haunted spooky place. And my grandmother was into it as well. And they loved spooky everything. So they would drag me and watch monster movies and all kinds of dumb stuff. But I got into the paranormal thing. And, you know, I'd watched Ghost Hunters was the first show that came out. And then, in 2004, is when Zach came onto the scene and with Ghost Adventures on Travel Channel. And I started watching his show back, you know, probably 2006 or 7 is when I first discovered him. I think it was a couple of years into his run. And I was like, well, this guy is weird and neat, but he's like, they're just like these young guys that are like my age. And they're just out there, just no big camera crews, no, nothing fancy, just three dudes going into a building and locking themselves in and seeing what happens. And I'm like, this is neat. And so years go by and I keep watching the show. And around, it was about 6 years ago, I had gotten really sick. And I was in Austin, Texas, working on a show. And I got really sick and I wound up in the hospital. And for 8 days, I was in a hospital. I wound up getting pancreatitis. And so I was in the hospital trying not to die and feeling like I was. And I was, you know, hooked up to machines and stuff because I was really very ill. And Ghost Adventures was on. And I was just watching this in my hospital room over and over and over again. And then all of a sudden, you know, then I got out and I went on tours and doing all this stuff. 2 years later, a mutual friend of Zach and I messaged me while I was on tour and like, hey, do you know anybody who does sideshow stuff that wants to work at the Haunted Museum? And I'm like, yeah, me. And she's like, really? I'm like, yeah. So he had wound up, I guess, he saw some of my TV stuff and he was like, oh, we can't, he's too big for me for this museum. We can't afford him. And I'm like, well, why don't you talk to me? Maybe you don't know, maybe. Because if I really like something, I don't care. I just want to do it. And so he turned me down twice, said no, no, no. And then all of a sudden I got an email from him. And he was like, hey, what are you doing right now? I'm like, nothing. I'm sitting in my house. He's like, come on down to the museum. I want to talk. So I drove over. I was like, I live like 10 minutes away from the museum. So I drove over there and we started talking. And it was a really weird interview, to be honest with you. Like, I go in this little secret room. There's all these monitors with video, with the security cameras. And there's a TV on. He's watching golf. And I'm like, big golfer? He's like, no, I just like watching it. I'm like, oh, okay. So we watched golf for like 10, 15 minutes, something like that. And then he's like, hey, you want to go scare people? I'm like, yeah. So we started going around the house. Like, and this is back when the museum was not very busy like it is now. Now it's like we're packed from open to close. But so we went in there and he's like, well, you know, there's this little circus room and, you know, I want a live sideshow act. So I was like, well, I can do this. I pitched him all the different things. And he's like, all right, that sounds cool. He's like, so like, when can you start? I was like, I don't know, tomorrow. And he's like, well, I'll tell you what. He's like, why don't you go get a costume, show it to me, and then just buy it and then save the receipts and I'll pay you back. I was like, great. So I went to the costume shop. I put together an entire like vintage looking carnival sideshow guy costume, sent him all the stuff. And he's like, well, why don't you just start tomorrow? I'm like, great. Boom. And then that was it. That was the whole thing. And here 4 years later, I'm still working with.
Well, let me ask you this, John. Let me ask you, do you have a ghost story? Did you have a paranormal experience? You think you'd
want to say? Yeah. So I had this. Now, this is, I had a couple. One in particular, I had come back from working on Norwegian Cruise Lines as part of a show called Illusionarium that Jeff Hobson had put together. It had Osander and James DeMare and Michael Giles and all these magicians and Alain New and stuff. And so they had hired me to be like their the lead magic tech for the show because I built props. So then I was hired for that. So I was on that ship for like 2 years. I come back to Vegas, and of course, you know, I'd given up my apartment and everything, put everything in storage because I was going to be on a ship for a couple of years. I didn't need any of this stuff. So I come back and I'm staying at one of those like hotels that they're furnished hotel basically. Apartment kind of a thing,
like Seagull breakfast kind of thing, or
yeah, it was called Seagull Suites. It's like these kind of ghetto-y kind of places. But I was like, I just needed a place to stay. You could pay weekly, so I was like, this is great. So I'm staying there, and I'm there for a little while, probably a couple weeks, and I'm laying in bed one night, and I wake up, and there's an old woman, and I swear. On everything you can imagine, this is exactly what I saw. An old woman walking in front of the bed, crying into her hands, and she just walked right past the bed and then vanished. And then a few seconds later, she reappeared and came back again. And it kept doing that over and over and over again. And then I was like, I'm waking up, I'm like kind of like half out of it going, what the hell am I looking at? And then I started looking around the room, and all of a sudden I started seeing other things. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? And it freaked me out. Yeah, it freaked me out. And I started freaking out. I'm like laying in bed, like, holy shit. And I just sat up in bed, and I'm like, I couldn't believe what the hell was going on. And I'm like, no one's going to ever believe this. But this went on for hours. Wow. And it went on not for hours. It lasted into the next day. And during the day, I was also seeing weird stuff in this place. And it was very, very bizarre. This lasted for a couple of days.
And that was first real experience. That was a solid.
Like, I've had other weird things, but nothing I would like, you know, put a flag in and say, burp, this is what it is. I had a weird experience when my grandmother had died. I went to the hospital. We knew she was going to be dying soon because she was very sick with cancer and everything. And I said goodbye to her. I was like, hey, I have a show tonight. I'm going to come back tomorrow. She's like, okay. So I went home. I was getting changed, ready to go do the show. It was like I was at a nightclub, and I was getting ready to do the show, and my phone rang in my room. You got to understand, this is also back in the day when caller ID was a thing, and it was on a fax machine. So that gives you an idea of what was going on at that time period, right? So I was in the bathroom. I run down the hall to go into my room where the phone was, and it was all zeros. And I was like, well, that's weird. And it rang like once, and that was it. And then it stopped. And I was like, huh. I picked it up, just dialed tone. I'm like, oh, whatever. Put it down. A few seconds later, the phone rings again. and I picked it up and it was my sister. And she was like, we're at the hospital, Nan just died. And I was like, and I didn't even put the whole thing before, didn't even put that, that fell out of my brain completely as soon as I was told she died. So I had to go do a show that night, by the way, and pretend to be happy and funny because that's your job. And it wasn't until probably a few days later, I processed what was going on. And I'm like, you know, it was really weird. And I said it to my mom. I'm like, this happened. And she's like, really? I'm like, yeah, it's weird. Like, that doesn't make any sense. But then as I got more into the paranormal stuff and like researching it, there's reports of things where stuff reaches out and can influence electronic stuff and, you know, trying to like just boom, like there's a blast of energy. Because we know scientifically, energy does not go away.
That's true.
It doesn't, just vanish. It changes and goes somewhere. So it's like, but I'm always on the fence still even to this day. I'm like, I'm on both sides where I'm like super skeptical and like not super trusting about it. And even my own eyes, like I doubt myself about like what I'm experiencing. But I've also had just so many things. And now when I work at the museum, I mean, on a daily basis, stuff happens. Today, I had a lady today, just happened a couple of hours ago, was in my room. And my room is part of the VIP tour, is part of one of the sections that I do. This lady put her head into this back area where Aaron had caught like spirit voices during the show. And she screamed, ran out of the wagon. And I was like, what did you see? And she wouldn't tell me. And I'm like, I was like, tell me, what did you see? And she's like, she had her head in the window and a man's face came up from underneath the window and came towards her face, like that towards her face. And she screamed some obscenities and ran out of the, wow, out of the wagon. Yeah. And I mean, and that happened today, you know,
I mean, I'm with you. Happened. I'm with you on the, I've had some experience. Now I do believe in the, there's something. Let me just say that. Yeah. There's something going on. I don't know what it is.
Or being real, then it not being real, but then I flip-flop around sometimes. So,
but I'm a skeptic too. I mean, I don't believe everything, you know, everything that comes my way. A lot of times I will shoot it down. It annoys the hell out of Antoinette, my wife. She's like, what do you mean? Yeah. You know, but.
Or photos are my most hated things in the world.
Well, you know, one thing that turns me off, and you see a lot of these videos of this, is like when they show the stuff of the poltergeist where the cabinets are flying open and things are flying off the tables. You and me both know how easily that can be fake.
Yeah. Exactly.
And I see that, and I'm like, you know, I could totally do that. Like, right, give me 10 minutes, you know, and we can make a video.
I could make something very similar.
Exactly.
And modern technology, and I mean, literally, you can make this stuff on your phone. Like, you can make a spirit photo or a spirit video on your phone and make it look like it's a security camera footage. Like, that's the problem, you know? Technology is so good. There's 12-year-old, 13-year-old kids that make better videos than, you know, anybody. So I'm like, it's hard when I see stuff on video to even like, unless I know who did it. Like, exactly. If I know that person, then I'm like, okay, well, that's different because I know you're not into this. But like, sometimes I'm like, I don't know. I want to believe it, but I'm like, I'm on the fence and I just don't know if I could.
Well, let me do this. First of all, John, man, dude, you do so much cool shit, bro. And you've done so much cool shit. I got to get to this. I have to get to this, or I'm not going to sleep tonight. You've been on it. You've done a lot of damn cool ass media, man. You've been on a lot of cool shows. A lot of cool stuff. First, I've got to ask this: what in the world was it like going on the Howard Stern show?
It was awesome.
Let's hear it.
To be honest with you, I was super nervous. Super nervous because I knew. I've been listening to Howard Stern for a long time, and I know his format, and I know he was going to be ready to tear me apart. So I was picking my words, and I had jokes lined up in my head. I rehearsed over and over and over again. Okay, I'm going to be doing these bits. These are the possible things he might say to me. You know, of course, you'd be like, what's wrong with you? You're an idiot, you know, blah, blah, blah. Those are just normal ones, and you can blow them off. I don't care. But I was like, man, what if he has something really, if he says something super clever? And Jackie the Joke Man was on at the time, too. And he's a professional stand-up comedian. And he's super funny, and he's very quick. And, you know, way better than I am. And so I'm like going, okay, man, I gotta be on my game. You know, and it's like butt crack at AM, by the way, that you had to be there. And I sat in the green room for like a couple of hours before we even got on the show. And, it was a surreal moment walking into that studio. I mean, I watched the video and I'm like, oh man, I look like a cool cucumber, but I was freaking out so hard. Because the thing you can't see when on camera are all the cameras in the ceiling that are moving around. There were all these robot cameras that were moving in the ceiling. He's behind this desk with purple lights and stuff on him, and Robin's in the box, and Jackie's over here, and you're hearing all these people in the headphone, right? But you can't see them. So I hearing voices, and I'm looking around, and the cameras are moving. There's a guy on the floor with a camera in my face and all this stuff, and they're like directing me to stand on my marks and all that jazz. And I'm like, holy crap, man, this is a lot going on right now. And then he starts talking to me, and I'm like, holy crap, this is really happening. And then I had to pretend like, man, this is no big deal. You know, meanwhile, inside I'm like, holy shit, you know.
So is Howard pretty cool in real life?
He was very skeptical of me, number one, which is fine. And then when I started to do the bits, and he started to give me some shit, and I just plowed through. I just was like, nope, I'm not, I'm just going to go. And I went all in, and then he just like was like, oh wow. And then I got them on my side. And then I started with the popcorn bit, with the popcorn kernels up the nose and out the eye. And when I did that, their reaction was just over the top. And then I went into the eating light bulb and stuff. And then they were just freaking out. And Jackie's like almost puking. They're all like, stop. No, you're going to die now. And it was like such great reactions. It was awesome. And I mean, he gave me a great compliment. He was like, hey, John, I ain't never seen nothing like that before. And I'm like, oh, this is gold.
Let me do this. It was Jay Leno that you were on, correct? Was it the
show? Yeah.
How was Jay towards you?
Well, it wasn't my most pleasant experience for a talk show. So I got the gig through Craigslist, believe it or not.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So they had a hidden. So a lot of the back in the day, you used to be able to get great gigs like this. I don't know if it still does it, but. I used to find all kinds of crazy things because the producers would look for people on Craigslist, but not tell you what it was. So you'd have to sift through all this stuff. This is why I tell people about the business. Like, it's not the stage that you're getting paid for. You're getting paid for all the other things. I do the show for free because I love it. I get paid for the travel, for the aggravation, for all the time and effort I put in to try to find these gigs and put together publicity material and do all that stuff. That's what I get paid for. I don't get paid the show. I don't. I love to do the show. The show is fun. It's everything else that sucks.
The traveling.
So I got the gig and I pitched them the popcorn thing and they're like, well, would you be willing to shave your beard? And I'm like, well, I would, but you know, it's going to cost this much. And they're like, oh, well, you know, we can't pay that much. I'm like, well, then I'm not shaving the beard. And they're like, oh, okay. Well, let us figure out another segment. A couple of months go by. They call me back and they're like, hey, we want to do a segment with you and Ed Asner. Well, you know, does this impress Ed Asner kind of thing? I'm like, great, cool. I know I like Ed Asner. That's great. So, they fly me out. At the time I was in New York at the time. So I flew from New York out to Burbank. And, you know, they put me up at the hotel and all that kind of jazz. And, they pick me up the next day in a nice big old limousine. They treated me really nice. Like I 5-star treatment, 100%. You know, I had a great airline. They picked me up in a limousine, brought me to the hotel. They paid for all my food, put me in a really nice room, picked me up in a limousine, brought me to the studio. I invited some friends and they gave them tickets to come and watch me perform. So I was treated wonderfully by the staff and all that jazz, no problem. We get to rehearsal. rehearsal is great. The great part about rehearsal was we had to wait because Willie Nelson was on stage rehearsing his segment. Yeah, so that was super badass. And they were like, oh, just go sit in the audience and wait till Willie's done, and then we're going to have you guys. I'm like, okay, cool. So I'm sitting in the audience, and I look over, and like three seats away from me is Burt Reynolds. Oh. And I'm like, holy shitballs. I'm like, Burt Reynolds. I was like, oh, my God, Burt, fucking Smokey the Bandit. And I was like, you know, and I was like freaking out. I'm like, you know, the little kid in me, like, I used to watch that stuff with my mom and dad. My dad especially loved him and Dom DeLuise, you know. And that was like, a, you know, our bonding stuff. We would watch Smokey and the Bandit and all that shit. And I was just like, I went over to him. I was like, I just want to say I love all your stuff. And I think you're really great. And he was like, thank you so much. And he was really nice. He was so nice. Willie Nelson, so nice. Everybody was great. So then I do my rehearsal. We do all the camera blocking for the bit and all that kind of jazz. And then they send me upstairs to my dressing room to sit and wait like you do. Cause a lot of this job is hurry up and wait. You hurry up and you wait, you hurry up and wait, you hurry up and wait. And that's television and movies and all those things, especially when you're at a low level. You do a lot of that. So, but they had a really nice, they had my own dressing room. I had a little plaque on the door with my name on it, which I still have, because it's super cool. And then Jay comes up a little while later and he's like, hey, you know, how you doing? And, you know, he's, you know, Jay Leno. And he's like, so like, you know, when we get ready to do the show, you know, I know like you do like comedy stuff with your bits, but like, you know, we're going to do the comedy. Don't try to be funny. And I'm like, but that's like the bit. And you're like, yeah, no, don't do it. And then the producers were like, yeah, you know, Jay is a professional comedian. And I'm like, yeah, no shit. I was like, so am I. Maybe I'm not famous, but that doesn't matter. That doesn't mean I'm not a professional comedian. So he's like, well, you know, let Jay and Ed do their thing. And you just kind of, you know, just answer the questions, but don't try to do jokes and bits and stuff. I'm like, oh, you motherfucker. So I knew what this was. Here's the deal. If I wanted to do the way I wanted to do it, they'll just edit me out. And then, but still, if it doesn't air, it doesn't do me any good. So I had to, it was one of those moments where I had to make a conscious decision. Do I do my material and stay true to my act? Or do I do what's good for my business and do what they need me to do so that I get the video footage and the reel and the credit that I need for my act for business? And I made the decision to do the business part of it. So I went there and I just played along and smiled and did my little monkey dance. Ed Asner was really cool. Afterwards, he came up to me. We started talking about old sideshows and carnivals. And he's like, I go to the Magic Castle. You been to Magic Castle? I'm like, yeah. He's like, you know AJ? I'm like, yeah, I know AJ. And he's like, oh my God. And we started talking about somebody. He was super cool. And then Tom Selleck came out of the back and he was like, I just watched your thing. He's like, oh my God. He was like, you know, it's really crazy. He's like, I watched what you did. I didn't know if I should like it, but I did like it. And I don't know how I feel about that. He's like, yeah, he's like, it was just crazy. And then Carlos Mencia was also on the show as well, and he came up to me and he was like, oh my God, man, I saw you did it. Like, that was so funny. So it was like all these little moments backstage where all these like big famous people were coming up to me, and I was like, this is amazing. I was like, you know, awesome. And yeah, it was just such a great experience overall. The fact that I couldn't just be me, that was the only part I wasn't super thrilled with. But it's part of the job. Like, you know, you're not always going to be able to do what you want, especially when you don't have the clout to do that. And I understand it's called show business. So it's not always about the show. Sometimes it's about the business. And you have to make decisions.
It's awesome, dude. You did get a hell of a credit, too. So,
yeah.
And I mean, absolutely.
And it came. And it looked fine, and people were like, oh my God, you were on the Tonight Show. And that's all they hear. That I'm like, oh, really? Okay.
That's badass, you know? That is, dude. That's badass. You were, I mean, dude, you got an impressive ass resume, especially when it comes to credits. You do. And not too many people can say they were on the Howard Stern Show. That is freaking badass. But let's do this. Go ahead.
He got me on Ripley's Believe It or Not. This is a thing a lot of people don't know. So, That day that I did the show, a producer in LA was listening to the Howard Stern Show from Ripley's, Believe It or Not, called into the show after I left and was like, does it look as good as it sounded? They're like, yeah. You're like, can you give me his phone number? Stern's people gave them my phone number, and I got booked to be on Ripley's Believe It or Not TV show because of Stern.
That is...
So,
let's do this. Let's do this. Because you have done a lot of gigs. You have done a lot of stuff. We ask every entertainer on the Abracadam podcast to tell a hell gig story. Let's hear it.
So this was, I don't remember what year it was. I want to say probably early 90s, 92, maybe 93. I've never forgotten this one because I learned a valuable lesson that day. I was doing this big magic and illusion show for this. I don't know if it was like a school or it was like a summer camp kind of a thing, something like that. And there was a big auditorium and I brought all my stuff and my sound and I'm going to be a super magic guy. And I'm getting all my stuff and I had snakes and I had all kinds of crazy crap, right? I'm setting up all my stuff and all the kids are in the bleachers. And right before they introduced me, they're like, coming up next, John Shaw and his magic show. But first, everybody, food's ready outside. And they literally wiped the entire audience away on me. And I'm left standing there like a friggin' idiot with all this stuff and like three kids watching the show. And I'm like, I looked at them and I'm like, what the hell did you just do? And they're like, oh, well, can't you just do the show? I'm like, yeah, to who? There's nobody here.
I can't compete with Sloppy Joe's.
Exactly. Yeah. They're like, well, they're going to come back. I'm like, awesome. And so I waited like a half an hour and then they got the kids to trickle back in. And then I started the show and we finished. But it was like, that was that moment I learned. Never compete against food. Either always go on before the food. Always go on before the food. Don't ever perform during food because nobody gives a shit. No matter how great a magician you are, you could be David Copperfield producing the Statue of Liberty in the middle of the friggin' ocean, and if there's free pizza, nobody cares about your friggin' magic trick.
There's nothing worse than you ask somebody a question, they got a mouthful of chicken. You're just like, yeah, this is not gonna work.
But I've had some other beauties where, like, I was my first real big show here in Vegas was at the Excalibur, and they had this free stage upstairs, and I was doing four shows a day, 6 days a week. Which, man, you get really good at magic when you do it that much. I can tell you that. And I was doing I had fire eating, all kinds of stuff in the show. Well, I squirted lighter fluid onto my torches and I had squirted some on the floor behind my little dump pail that I had. All my magic went in and out of this garbage can that I decorated to look really fancy, but it was a garbage can on wheels basically. And, but it held all my props and I didn't really pay attention. And so I had the material stapled to the box, right? So that it hung down. And I went to go do something. I slipped on the lighter fluid and went and grabbed the edge of the box. And my fingers went right into those staples. And it punctured all of my entire hand, punctured every finger that I had. And I pulled my fingers back off of the staples. And I just see the blood running down my hand. And I'm like, going, I still had 20 minutes to go. and I had to finish the show. And I kept wet. Luckily, I had black. You know, I had black costume, so I would just wipe the blood on my costume and just did the so I was doing like silk magic. There's blood stains all over the silk. It was so, so bad. But that was another one that was really good.
Flashback. Let me ask you this. Okay, this is we're going to throw this a hypothetical question. Okay, I don't know. Well, let's kind of stick to kind of, this is a good one. John Shaw, let's say, you are abducted by aliens, okay? And you need to convince them to bring you back to Vegas. You got a show, bro. You got to get back, and you got to convince them to bring you back. What magic trick do you do to impress the aliens to get them to bring you back?
You know what? People underestimate the power of a good hot rod routine.
Nice.
They really do. Hot rod. I worked in a magic shop and I used to sell the hell out of hot rods because I figured out a really good routine that had everything in it that you could, it had a lot of magical moments in it. And it wasn't just like, here, pick a color or a number, whatever. And at the end, the thing would vanish. and reappear and then vanish completely. And people always make fun of the people. A lot of times people like they poo poo some of these like classic tricks or the beginner tricks. And I'm like, yeah, it's a beginner's trick, but if you do it as a professional, you should be better than like the standard version. You should have a version that will like, oh, magicians will be like, wow, that's really neat. Fuck, that's a great version of that. I had never seen that before, you know? And the hot rod has a lot of possibilities more than just the original version of the trick, I think.
You know and what, dude? That's an awesome
you can do cigarette with, be honest with you, it's the size of a cigarette. You can do all the cigarette manipulation stuff with a hot rod.
True.
You can.
Very well true. And see, people don't think. That brings it back. That brings it back to the beginning of the episode where we talk about the toys that you start off with, turn into tools later on, the whole process, the hot rod. Dude, I think that's a badass answer. Absolutely. Impress the hell out of them aliens with the hot rod. Yes.
Because it does a bunch of things. It's neat. It changes color. It vanishes. It reappears. Stuff like changes right in front of them. You know, you can do all kinds of stuff with it. I think it's an underrated effect. I really do. I've seen some people do some really cool stuff with a hot rod. And it's like magicians are so used to performing from like they wanted to just impress magicians. I don't know about you, but I don't work for magicians like ever.
Oh, I don't either.
You know, David Copperfield has come to my show now twice and has complimented me twice about how much he loves my snowstorm routine.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm like going, if this guy thinks a trick that obviously all of us know how this trick works, I mean, I have a particular version that I do that is weaved together with a bunch of different tricks, so it's not just like the standard version.
Yeah.
And you know, but it was like, I mean, it was a big deal for me to like have this guy that I watched on TV as a kid sit down with me for like a couple of hours and hold on a second. Boom. You there? Did I lose you?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here.
All right. You know, this guy that I idolized as a child and even into my teens and in my 20s and 30s, you know, he was the guy. And
yeah,
like,
he was. He was
sitting down with me, talking to me one-on-one about how much he enjoyed my show. And I'm like, it blowing my mind. Blowing my mind.
That's got to be surreal. I couldn't imagine that.
It's super weird. It's super weird. Like, I mean, I have his phone number now. It's the most bizarre thing in my life. I remember the first time he ever called me, he was like, give me your phone number. And I gave him my phone number. And I remember him calling me. And he's like, hi, this is David Copperfield. Yes, the real one. And I was like, no. I was like, this is so cool. And I actually have it in my phone, saved, David Copperfield. Yes, the real one. I have that, like, literally saved. As his
that
title, because
awesome.
Like, I can't believe, like, you know.
Now let me ask you this real quick, John. The first time David came and saw your show, did you know he was there, or did you find out?
I did not know he came. He bought a ticket, and came in and sat down. He bought a VIP ticket, of course, but you know, he bought a ticket and he sat in the back VIP booth of the theater. Didn't tell anybody he was showing up. He just did it on his own.
Wow!
And found out partway through the show that he was there. They came in the back, they're like, you know, David Copperfield watching your show. We're like, what? Like, we're watching our show? And he's like, yeah, he's been here since the beginning. And I'm like, no. So luckily, my part had been done. I did my bits by that point. I was like, man, I'm glad I didn't know that he was here. Oh my God, I've been shit myself. And he was so nice, and he hung out and he talked and took pictures. And like, it's one of those moments when you meet people that you look up to and that you admire, and they're so cool and genuine and nice, and it just makes you feel better about everything. And like, I mean, I'm not famous really or anything, but like there's people who know who I am and watch me on the different TV shows that I do. And like when I see their faces, see me, and they're like, oh my God, you're the guy. They, most of the time they don't know my name, but they remember my face, which is part of this whole look. But you know, I try to remember that moment when I've had those moments with somebody that I look at like that, and I try to make that moment great for that person. And I'll do whatever I have to do to make sure that they're happy. And one of the things I Gene Simmons wrote in his book, he was like, I sign every autograph and I take every picture, because without the fans, I would have nothing. I would be nothing. He's like, I live a life that I love because of them and only because of them. So take the 2 seconds it takes, take the picture, answer the question, smile, whatever it is. It doesn't matter if you're eating dinner. It doesn't matter anything. Do it because that's your job.
Absolutely.
And I'm like, and he's like, and I'm like, that's some of the best advice I've ever read in my life.
Let me ask
but
you
I've
this.
I've seen celebrities act like dicks and I don't get it. I'm like, you signed up for this.
Yeah.
You wanted to be recognized. What the hell do you think? I mean, I understand maybe if you're in the toilet or something, you know, and like, you know, or you're trying to have a family moment. I get that, but it's still, it takes 2 seconds to take the photo, jump back to your thing. And it's like, to me, it's just not a big deal.
I mean, you hear stories about celebrities being straight up douches, and I'm with you. I'm like, come on, man. I mean, but now I get it if you're with your family or, yeah, you're in the middle of something.
I mean, I understand. Sometimes you got to pick, but for these people, this might be their only opportunity to ever get that close to you in real life. And you have to realize that, like, it's an important moment in their life, and you are making or breaking somebody's entire world sometimes on that 1 second of just, all you got to do is be nice. It costs you nothing.
Yeah.
To be nice.
And you know, we don't,
it's free.
I don't think entertainers, I don't think we realize us that, you know, what kind of impact we make on people's lives that come to see our shows, you know? I always feel it doesn't happen all the time, but every now and then after the show, somebody will want me to, can I get your autograph? And I always feel like a freaking dork when they do, because I'm like, yeah. But, and I thought, well, you got to say something, you know? So I try to keep it magical. God, that's so dumb. You know, Danny Whitson, but you know, I don't think I'll ever get used to that, you know, but, I do it. They ask for it. And I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. You know, I'm literally, you know, a nobody, but here you go, you know? So, but for a big time celebrity, I don't think that, but you definitely got those douchebags out there that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've seen it a bunch and you know, it is what it is. And it's like, hey man, that's how you want to run your life. That's cool. But you know, for me, it's like, I mean, I'm so appreciative. Anybody cares enough about what I did that they want a picture of me. Like, I mean, you know, me, I'm like, they're like, they just want a picture with me just because they were like, oh my God, what you did impacted me so much that I want to save this moment. And it's, I tell people all the time, and it costs nothing to be nice to somebody. It really doesn't. You know, sometimes I'm out on a date or something like that. You know, people will come up and be like, oh my God, you know, I saw you at the museum. I saw you on Ghost Ventures or Pawn Stars or whatever, you know, and they're just like, I just wanted to say, hey, and can I get a picture? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. You know, and I ain't gonna lie. I mean, it's a huge ego boost and it definitely makes the date go better. But you know, but it's like one of those things where it's like, you know, I mean, yes, does it interrupt maybe the flow of me trying to, you know, sweet talk the young lady I'm out with? Of course. But at the same time, it's like that person had to get up the balls to come over to you, interrupt you in the middle of your life just because they just wanted to get close to you and take a photo. And it takes the amount of time it would tell me for me to tell them, no, I'm not really interested. I'm in the middle of something. I could have just done it already. It's the same amount of time that it takes to do those things. It's the same amount of time. I don't understand.
I'm grateful. You also built, I mean, you know, you take care of your fan base. You know what I mean? I mean, that person will come back.
I'm grateful anybody cares enough about me to do that kind of a thing. I'm like, oh, really? That's cool.
Well,
you know, some schmuck that tells dick jokes and puts drills in my nose.
Well, I tell you what, John, let's do this real quick, man. First of all, because I do know you are, you're performing. Are you performing right now? Is it Late Night Magic show?
Yeah, Late Night Magic. Yeah.
Okay.
So we're every Friday and Saturday night. At the Alexis Park Resort here in Las Vegas. The show's at 11 o'clock and it's an adults only magic comedy variety show kind of thing. It's 18 and over, that kind of a thing. So you can get, if you're in Vegas, you can get our tickets on ticketkite.com or you can buy through vegas.com because we're also on there as well. But yeah, you can come see us and you know, we have a revolving cast. We have a main cast, but then we do revolve acts in and out. Like this last week we had Susie Malone in, and who's an Australian burlesque magician, burlesque dancer magician, and stuff like that. And she was in doing a spot. And then my, when certain people are out, I do more illusions in the show. So we open with illusions and we have like a couple different illusions in the show. And I bring in my assistant and stuff like that. And then she helps out and nice. Stuff. But it's super. Sometimes we have Rudy Kobe does a spot.
Cool. Super cool.
Last night, are you familiar with Chris Kenner? Chris Kenner.
Yes. Hell yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So Chris is a good friend of mine, and he was at the show last night because it was my birthday show. So it was like Chris and Matt King and Nick Defot and Tape Face and everybody had come out to hang out with me because they're friends. And so like some of them are like, hey man, we want to do like a surprise guest spot one night, just come out and do stuff. And so like our show is starting to become like this really cool magic hang where like people can come and do like a little guest spot and stuff like that. And you can do whatever you want because there are no rules with our show. Nice. You can literally do and say whatever you want and it's fine. And that's what Chris loves about it. Cause he produces the biggest magician in the world. You know, he's David Copperfield's producer, the biggest magic show in the world. And he runs it. And he's like, I just want to come on and do like 10 minutes. and we're like, okay. And Mac is like, yeah, I just want to come work on and do some funny stuff that I can't do in my regular family show, but I can do it here. This is great. Yeah, so it's like, it's super fun. So you never know who's going to be in our show. And that's kind of, it's starting to become this thing where people are catching on. And we won Best of Las Vegas on our first year. We won Best of Las Vegas for Best Magic Show, and we placed, we placed third in the top three. Behind Shin Lim and Xavier Mortimer, so we're doing something that's never been done with a magic show here in town, and we're just trying to do our own thing. This show would never get play on the strip normally, but here we are, doing our thing anyway, and we're a year in, over a year in, and we're still here.
Dude, I love it. That is my kind of show too, by the way. Well, how can the listeners find more out about John Shaw?
You can find me on all the social medias. Look up on John Shaw Magic. That's you find me on Instagram and Facebook and all that kind of stuff. And I even have a TikTok now. I'm even doing the TikTok stuff. I suck at it, but I'm trying anyway. You can find me on TikTok under Devil Daddy 1369, and I post just weird, dumb crap that I find funny mostly. And, some of it's good, some of it's not, but it's fun anyway. I don't care.
Awesome.
But, you can find me on, Twitter too, under John Shaw 666, because everything else was taken.
Awesome.
But, and follow me on all the things and, reach out to me and send messages. I read everything. There's nobody looking at my stuff, so you can send me whatever you want.
Good deal, brother. Man, first of all, John, this has been a blast. I gotta have you back on because, like I said, I don't think an hour is enough with you because you've got so many cool things, you've done so much cool stuff. But man, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, dude. This was a blast.
Oh, you're very welcome, man.
All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that episode with John Shaw. Such an interesting dude, man. He has literally done it all. He has been everywhere. So many cool stories. I could probably talk with that guy for another hour. So much cool stuff. If you guys have not done so yet, be sure to like, subscribe, follow the Abracadam podcast on whatever platform it is you use. If you feel jumpy, be sure to jump over to Instagram and give me a follow at Super Magic Boy on Instagram. I post a lot of upcoming shows where I'm going to be as well. Also, let me give a quick show date announcement. April 30th, Johnson City, Tennessee. I'm going to be at the Wallace Theater along with my funny friend, Shelly Belly, a.k.a. Michelle Ryder from Netflix, The Circle. We're both going to be co-headlining that show, and it's going to be a blast. So if you guys are in the Johnson City, Tennessee area, be sure to pick up those tickets now because they are going fast at thewallacetheater.com. Also, let's say this. Texas, thank you for listening. I see you. And like always, Abracadamits, thank y'all for listening.
Abracadabra.
Will you please stop drinking vodka at my kid's birthday party?
Then you got a freaking miracle. There you go.